came in, they threatened that if people didn't leave, they would be killed. And settlers and soldiers then tortured a number of Palestinians who were there. Soldiers attacked some Israeli activists who were there in a protective capacity, accusing them, you know, saying, why aren't you in Gaza? Why are you protecting terrorists? Nerya Benbazi's lawyer had written in legal documents that he had extensive ties with the security establishment. So this is well established, even in the UN that I mentioned before, the 600 or so attacks that have happened since October 7th, the UN said that in at least half of those attacks, soldiers are present. It's not a coincidence. It's not merely just soldiers not stopping these settlers. There is an active and ongoing collaboration between many of them.
And you say these sanctions do not address this.
Right. Yeah. I mean, they're targeting these individuals, you know, a handful of individuals out of hundreds who are attacking Palestinians, and sort of, targeting them as individuals, but not the sort of state that is supporting them and encouraging them to continue to take land.
Journalist Shane Bauer's piece for The New Yorker is headlined, "The Israeli Settlers Attacking Their Palestinian Neighbors." And it's breaking news. The Irish Prime Minister has just resigned. I'm Amy Goodman.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO's board is recruiting directors. In preparation for our annual board election in September, KBOO's nominating committee will be holding virtual information sessions from now through June. KBOO's board of directors guides the station's strategic plan and represents the interests and visions of all of our members. BIPOC persons are especially encouraged to apply. More information and meeting times can be found at kboo.fm/board recruiting. Thank you for considering board work at KBOO.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland police are one step closer to creating a new riot squad dedicated to public protests.
In a major victory for the land back movement, the Yurok tribe has regained ownership of a former mill site in Northern California.
And in international news, Prince Harry says News Corp owner Rupert Murdoch knew about criminal acts committed by his media outlets to spy on celebrities for news coverage.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, March 20th, 2024. I'm Lisa Loving.
And I'm Reed Johnson. Portland's newly announced police riot squad will offer participating officers a 6% pay increase. At its meeting today, the Portland City Council unanimously approved a letter of agreement with the Portland Police Union for the pay raise. The 6% pay increase goes for all officers who agree to work on the new, quote, public order team. They'll receive the pay raise regardless of how many times they respond as part of the team. The city and the police union say the pay raise will serve as an incentive to attract, quote, high quality officers, end quote. The public order team comes from recommendations by Independent Monitor LLC, a third-party firm hired by the city to evaluate policing practices. In particular, the firm evaluated the PPB response to the 2020 racial justice protests. The new public order team takes over for the embattled rapid response team. The police used its rapid response team widely during the protests in 2020. It made national headlines for its frequent use of riot gear and tear gas. A study by the human rights research group Forensic Architecture concluded the use of CS tear gas far exceeded safe levels and were high enough to cause, quote, serious short-term and long-term side effects. The rapid response team eventually disbanded in 2021 in protest over a grand jury indictment of a member for fourth-degree assault charges coming from the protests. The Independent Monitor's report concluded police need to implement policies like updated training on effective crowd control and de-escalation, as well as, quote, dramatically reduce its reliance on riot control agents like CS gas, end quote. The PPB announced they are working to implement the firm's suggestions. They have yet to announce how big the public order team will be or when recruitment will commence. Costs from the previous riot team's misdeeds continue to accrue even in its absence. By mid-2023, the city has paid out a total of $3 million in settlements for more than 75 bodily injury claims against the rapid response team.
President Biden approved a federal funding package that gives Portland $7.1 million to invest locally. The money the city receives will subsidize major projects, including in East Portland, $2.3 million goes to install new safety features at two high-crash intersections on Division and Holgate. $2 million goes to 149 affordable apartments located in Southwest Portland. That includes the Barber Apartments, prioritizing housing for Muslim, North, and East African immigrants and refugees. This is important because the city's largest mosque is nearby, along with many Muslim organizations. Portland police officers will finally be required to wear body cameras, and $1.4 million will cover the cost and begin training for officers this summer. Portland is the last big city in the United States to require police to wear body cameras. A major fish passage in Tryon Creek will be replaced with nearly $1 million from the federal funding package. It will allow threatened Chinook salmon and steelhead trout to travel between Tryon Creek and the Willamette River underneath Highway 43. Lastly, a $500,000 will go towards the light pole safety project. The plan is to replace the bulbs with environmentally friendly LEDs. Unsafe light poles will also be replaced. The project addresses these issues in 11 city parks, including along the Selwood Riverfront, Montevilla, and Irving Park.
In state news, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife has killed off more than 150,000 rainbow trout after discovering a parasite at three different hatcheries. Fish and Wildlife detected an increase in dead rainbow trout in Klamath Falls, Rock Creek, and Elk River hatcheries late last year. The agency partnered with Oregon State University's College of Veterinary Medicine and Department of Microbiology to investigate the deaths. After testing the fish for bacteria and viruses, they were unable to identify any known pathogens. But scientists were able to find an unknown parasite in the trout's blood vessels, gills, and kidney tissue. COIN reports that to contain the rate of infections, the agency killed off about 160,000 trout between 8 and 10 inches long. Officials say that leaves 104,000 healthy trout at other hatcheries. 104,000. ODFW will conduct research on 500 infected fish to learn more about the parasite. Fish and Wildlife releases about 3.8 million of the species in Oregon every year.
The Yurok tribe has signed an agreement this week to regain ownership of a former mill site in Orrick, California. The site will be co-managed with state and federal land managers and start welcoming visitors in 2026. It's a first-of-its-kind co-management agreement. Suzanne Potter has more on the story.
Plans to open a new gateway to Redwoods State and National Parks got a big boost Tuesday, paving the way for a key parcel of land to be returned to the Yurok tribe. The place is called Oru in the Yurok language, on Highway 101, about 40 miles north of Eureka, at a former lumber mill site in Oryk. Yurok tribal leader Joseph James says this is a model for the land back movement.
Able to share our culture, our knowledge as indigenous people, first people, keepers of the land. It's not driven by Western society providing interpretation. It's being driven by Yuroks.
The nonprofit Save the Redwoods League bought the 125-acre property 13 years ago and has been restoring the mill site and nearby Prairie Creek alongside the tribe and the nonprofit California Trout. This area is closed for construction now, but will reopen in 2026 as the Oru Redwoods Gateway, with new trails, cultural signage, and visitor facilities. Redwoods National Park Superintendent Steve Metz says this is the first ever co-management agreement for tribally owned land with the National Park Service and California State Parks.
So this is just a recognition of their sovereignty, their need to regain land that was taken from them years ago and turning it back and creating greater understanding about the original people in this area.
In future years, the Yurok tribe plans to build a full visitor center, including recreating a tribal village with plank houses and a sweat lodge. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
The Portland Public School Board has decided on how to make up for lost time from the teacher strike and ice storm. An Oregon rule, commonly known as Division 22, requires districts to ensure students receive between 900 and 990 hours of instruction. Currently, kindergartners and high school seniors face the greatest instructional time deficits. Last Tuesday, the school board approved plans to apply for a waiver from the Oregon Department of Education. The waiver would strike 14 instructional hours from the mandatory limit for all grades. For seniors specifically, the district further plans to convert time for standardized testing and professional development into hours in the classroom. The board also considered reducing recess time in April for kindergartners. They ultimately decided against it. Board member Andrew Scott was one of those arguing against converting recess to class time. Scott said, quote, "I actually would be in favor of us just straight up violating the Division 22 guidelines this year and saying, you know what, it is more important for our kindergartners to get the additional 15 minutes of recess than to meet those minimum standards the state sets," end quote. Even with this new resolution, most PPS high schools will remain at least 10 hours short of state minimums.
Portland's Office of Community and Civic Life has mismanaged the historic Kenton Firehouse since taking over the building in 2022, according to a city audit published last week. The audit says mismanagement allowed State Representative Travis Nelson to occupy city-owned space for 2 years without paying rent. While Civic Life owns the firehouse, they claim they do not hold the authority to collect rental fees. That authority was never reestablished after the nonprofit North Portland Community Works ceased operations in 2022. The nonprofit had overseen the upkeep and maintenance of the building since 2000. Their work was funded through rental fees from community groups and public officials using the firehouse. Yet auditors say there was no formal agreement between Civic Life and the nonprofit. This leaves unanswered the question of how much rent was collected and where it went over those 22 years. Since 2022, Civic Life has failed to generate rental revenue for the property. According to the report, community members hoping to rent the property have been waitlisted, while staff in Representative Nelson's office say the city never invoiced them for rent. Instead, maintenance costs have been sustained by reallocating $30,000 from the Civic Life budget. Auditors recommend Civic Life solidify its authority over renting and leasing or transfer the building to a different bureau. A third option would be for the city to sell the building. The Kenton Firehouse has been a community space for nearly half a century.
The Environmental Working Group released their new report, 2024 Shopper's Guide to Pesticides in Produce, that features the quote-unquote dirty dozen non-organic produce items. Topping the list again are strawberries, spinach, kale, as well as collard and mustard greens. Of particular concern to the report's authors are that 4 out of 5 of the most frequently detected pesticides found in the dozen items were fungicides that could have serious health impacts. EWG senior scientist Alexa Friedman said, quote, "There's data to suggest that these fungicides can disrupt the hormone function in our body." She added that these chemicals had, quote, "been linked to things like worse health outcomes and impacts on the male reproductive system." Beyond fungicides, testing also found the neonicotinoids acetamiprid and imidacloprid. These harm bees and other pollinators and have been associated with damage to the development of children's nervous systems. Topping the list of produce items with the least pesticides are sweet corn, avocados, pineapples, and onions.
An appeals court has stayed a controversial Texas border exclusion law. With more on the story, it's Catherine Carley with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We haven't had a government shutdown since 2019. There's no good reason for us to have one this week, now that we're getting very close to finishing the job.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer says congressional leaders have reached agreement on spending to avoid a government shutdown. Lawmakers are now racing to draft the legislation so the bills can be voted on before a Friday night deadline. An appeals court has again stayed a controversial Texas immigration law after some late-night confusion. State and local officials are again temporarily barred from arresting and deporting people they suspect illegally crossed the border. The White House says that would be an unprecedented intrusion into federal immigration enforcement. But Texas Governor Greg Abbott says the Constitution allows him to defend his state from what he calls an invasion.
The authors of the United States Constitution foresaw a situation when the federal government would be inattentive to states that faced challenges at their borders.
Former President Donald Trump says he may have to sell properties at fire sale prices to pay the nearly $500 million civil fraud bond due next week. At least 30 companies declined to underwrite his bond. New York Attorney General Letitia James says she hasn't ruled out seizing one of his marquee properties.
We are prepared to make sure that the judgment is paid to New Yorkers. And yes, I look at 40 Wall Street each and every day.
An Arizona lawmaker spoke on the floor of the state Senate, announcing her plans to have an abortion after learning her pregnancy is not viable. Current law bans the procedure after 15 weeks, but State Senator Ava Birch says people should not have to justify their medical decisions.
I'm choosing to talk about why I made this decision because I want us to be able to have meaningful conversations about the reality of how the work that we do in this body impacts people in the real world.
Birch says state law has required her to undergo an invasive ultrasound not ordered by her doctor. A signature drive now underway would put a state constitutional right to abortion on the ballot in Arizona this fall. A federal judge has sentenced a Mississippi sheriff's deputy to 20 years for his part in the racially motivated torture of 2 black men. 5 other deputies in the group that referred to itself as the Goon Squad will be sentenced this week. Attorney Trent Walker represents the victims and says the deputies should face the harshest of consequences.
Almost every police car in America has the words "to protect and serve." Yeah. But you can't protect one segment of the community and then persecute another segment of the community.
5 states held presidential primaries Tuesday, even as President Joe Biden and Trump have already locked up their nominations. Florida Democrats canceled their primary, opting to award the state's delegates to Biden. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Jeremiah Hayden from Street Roots about his latest article on the Policing Justice exhibition showing now at PICA. At 6 p.m., it's Beyond Your Front Door. At 6:30, it's Free Culture Radio. And then at 7, Culture in Motion. Tonight's weather will be rain showers, lows around 45 degrees. Tomorrow's weather, warm rain, highs around 62 degrees. Today in history, in 2016, Barack Obama became the first president to visit Cuba in 88 years. And our quote of the day is from Cuban revolutionary Che Guevara, who said, quote, "I am not a liberator. Liberators do not exist. the people liberate themselves.
Two U.S. Supreme Court rulings this week will set the stage for state and local elected officials to be banned from office for life if found to have engaged in, quote, insurrection, unquote, or offering, quote, aid and comfort to enemies of the Constitution, unquote. On Monday, the court rejected an appeal from a former New Mexico County Commissioner convicted of trespassing during the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol, who was kicked out of office for his participation. The state judge cited Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, designed to prevent Confederates from returning to government after the Civil War. Earlier this year, the Supreme Court ruled that states could not use the 14th Amendment to bar people from federal office if they engaged in insurrection, unless Congress passes a new law explicitly laying out that provision. That means former President Donald Trump remains unaffected by a national campaign to end his bid to return to the White House.
And earlier today, the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee held a hearing on reproductive freedom and abortion access. Since Roe v. Wade was overturned, at least two dozen states have enacted bans on the medical procedure. KBOO's Doug McVeigh has more from the Senate floor.
The U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee held a hearing March 20th on the continued assault on reproductive freedoms in a post-Dobbs America. This was the committee's third hearing on reproductive freedom since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in June of 2022. One of the witnesses who testified was Dr. Austin Denard, an OBGYN based in Dallas, Texas.
Nothing brings me more joy than being a mother to my three children, but a close second is being an OBGYN. I get to be present for the most incredible moments. There's nothing quite like a moment when a baby is born and a family is created. I've delivered thousands of babies and it still takes my breath away. But intertwined and these celebrations are also moments of complete heartbreak. Pregnancy loss, devastating diagnosis, infertility. Since SB 8 was enacted and Dobbs' decision came down in 2022, those tough moments have become even more tragic. In Texas, where my husband and I both practice medicine, we live in fear as physicians and as patients. I can speak to both of these perspectives because I am a Texan and an OBGYN who needed an abortion in Texas and could not get one. After careful consideration and many prayers, my husband and I were delighted to find out that we were pregnant again in the summer of 2022. Between our two toddlers and growing surgical practices, we were feeling really busy but also very blessed. But at 11 weeks of pregnancy, I had a routine ultrasound that changed the course of my family's life forever. The brain and skull had not formed. It was anencephaly, the most severe neural tube defect, 100% fatal. I will never forget looking up at that ultrasound screen in complete disbelief and devastation. I needed an abortion, but would have to flee my state to get one. Texas, where I've lived for six generations, where I practice medicine and where I'm raising my family. My mind began to spin. Where would I go? Who would take care of me? Who will take care of my children? What about my patients? And what if this is the last time I ever get to be pregnant? Because of Texas's new laws, we were afraid to use credit cards or even tell people why we were traveling to the East Coast so suddenly. I was terrified my husband would be arrested for aiding and abetting my abortion, just for traveling with me. And under Texas's new laws, the penalties were so severe, 100 years in prison, huge fines, a loss of our medical license. It was humiliating. Through it all, I felt so broken and abandoned by my home state. But at the same time, I had never seen my luck and privilege with more clarity. What would other people do in my place who could not afford the extensive costs and lost wages? No one should have to be lucky to access essential medical care. As heartbreaking and traumatizing as that was for me, it is even more disturbing to be a working OBGYN in Texas. trying to abide by these paralyzing and punitive laws while still providing timely, compassionate, and ethical care for my patients. Conversations in my office are different now. Couples arrive for their pregnancy confirmation visits filled with worry. They know how much is at stake. What if it's an ectopic? What if I start bleeding? What if I become really, really sick? I have the same answer for all of them, that I will do everything in my power to keep them safe. But still, we collectively hold our breath as we pass the pregnancy milestones, because my patients know that lawmakers have stripped away their rights to make decisions about their own health, their own body, and their own family. So long as they remain on Texas soil, their pregnancies belong to the state. Exceptions are said to exist in the laws, but in reality, it's fiction.
That was Dr. Austin Denard, an OBGYN based in Dallas, Texas, testifying March 20th before the Senate Judiciary Committee on the continued assault on reproductive freedoms in a post-Dobbs America. Reporting for KBOO News, I'm Doug McVeigh.
The Biden administration has announced strict reductions of vehicle tailpipe emissions, down 56% by 2032. The EPA says the rule will save the nation $99 billion a year, including $46 billion in reduced fuel costs and nearly $16 billion in repairs and maintenance. The main way to achieve this pollution reduction is more electric and plug-in hybrid vehicles. Under this plan, electric vehicles could account for over half the new vehicles sold between 2030 and 2032. Transportation is the largest source of planet-warming emissions in the United States, with passenger cars and trucks accounting for the majority of that. The new plan stretches out the time for the standards to be met. Auto manufacturers and auto worker unions pushed for the extension, in part because workers making electric vehicles are paid less than those in traditional factories. Many environmentalists are not happy with the extension. Dan Becker of the Center for Biological Diversity said, quote, "This rule could have been the biggest single step of any nation on climate, but the EPA caved to pressure from big auto, big oil, and car dealers, and riddled the plan with loopholes big enough to drive a Ford F-150 through. Republicans have already launched plans to go after the new regulation, and Donald Trump has said he would repeal Biden's, quote, insane electric vehicle mandate," unquote, on his first day of office.
Native American Interior Secretary Deb Haaland is campaigning for the Biden-Harris ticket with careful language. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland has started making campaign appearances for the Biden-Harris ticket. She spent part of last weekend at events in Wisconsin. Chuck Kornbach of Station WUWM reports.
Cabinet secretaries and many other federal employees have to be careful about engaging in political campaigning. So a Biden-Harris press release announcing Haaland's four stops in Wisconsin referred to her as the Honorable Deb Haaland. And here's how Haaland introduced herself at a Democratic Party headquarters in the city of Sheboygan.
I will just reiterate the fact that I'm here in my personal capacity. Everybody here can call me Deb. Leave off the title, please.
Haaland spoke for about 12 minutes, praising the work of President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris. Then she turned her remarks to the record of former president and likely 2024 GOP nominee, Donald Trump.
Remember going to sleep each night with a pit in your stomach, wondering what you were going to wake up to the next morning, or which world leader he'd pick a fight with next.
At earlier stops in Green Bay and Shawnee, Haaland spoke to audiences that included many members of the Oneida and Menominee Nations. Gracie Waukeshon is a student at the Menominee College and is an enrolled member of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa. Waukeshon introduced Haaland at the Shawnee event and says the Interior Secretary is a big plus in tribal areas.
To have a Native person in cabinet and to travel across Wisconsin as a surrogate for President Biden, it is not only effective, but it gets a positive response, and we really love her up in Menominee County.
Waukesha is getting ready to vote in her first presidential election. President Biden will need all the help he can get in Wisconsin. He only won the state by about 20,000 votes 4 years ago, and polls show him in a tight race with Trump this year. A Biden campaign official says Deb Haaland is planning to do more campaign stops around the U.S. For National Native News, I'm Chuck Quernbach.
Tribal leaders came to the Colorado Capitol recently for Ute Day, highlighting the Ute Mountain Ute and Southern Ute tribes. They called on lawmakers to follow through with promises made last year. KUNC's Lucas Brady Woods reports for the Mountain West News Bureau.
The tribe's leaders addressed a joint session of the legislature. They praised the state government's tribal engagement efforts, but said more needs to be done. Southern Ute Chairman Melvin J. Baker said the tribes have not been given equal access to sports betting, even though it was legalized statewide 4 years ago. He said tribal leaders met with Governor Jared Polis about this last year.
He assured us that one of the priorities would be to visit the tribe and to resolve this issue. Enough is enough. We are tired of broken promises.
Baker and Ute Mountain Ute Chairman Manuel Hart also called for more state support around health care, education, and water rights. I'm Lucas Brady Woods at the state capitol.
U.S. Senator Brian Schatz spoke on the Senate floor Tuesday to highlight $1.3 billion in federal funding for Native housing programs. It's part of a six-bill appropriations package signed into law last week.
The historic funding is a very, very big deal. It means that they can build more affordable housing, provide rental assistance, and get electricity and plumbing into their homes.
Schatz, who chairs the Indian Affairs Committee and Appropriations Subcommittee on Transportation, Housing, and Urban Development, says there's also new federal funding for tribal transportation.
In England this week, Prince Harry says News Corporation owner Rupert Murdoch knew about